I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. What does it take to forgive an abusive parent, especially when old age and dementia rob them of their ability to say they're sorry? Our guest, writer Matthew Quick, explores that provocative and poignant question in his new book, a memoir titled Dad, Love Me. His father terrorized the family with his rages, his cruelty, and his coldness, leaving Matthew anxious and depressed. He became a popular writer of YA fiction after his first novel, The Silver Linings Playbook, was a bestseller and later an Oscar-winning movie. But he couldn't enjoy his success and turned to alcohol to manage his feelings of worthlessness. Becoming sober led to writer's block and eventually to Jungian therapy. With the help of his therapist, Matthew started exploring his family's history of intergenerational trauma, including his own traumatic childhood. As he began putting his emotional pieces of his life together, his dad developed dementia, which allowed Matthew to see a more vulnerable, even loving side of his father. Matthew Quick joins us today on The Connection to tell his story and what it can reveal about the relationship between fathers and sons. Matthew Quick, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks so much, Marty, for having me. It's a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. This book is written in the form of a letter to your dad. You say that a lot, you. And yet it's a book he probably will never read because he has dementia. Why did you choose that form?
I wanted to write about my dad for many, many years. When I went into my MFA program at Goddard in Vermont back in 2000, and I don't know what that year was, 2005. That was the first thing I said, is I want to write this letter. I want to write a book about my father. Mm-hmm. And I kept trying and trying, and it wouldn't come. And one of the things that I found was an impediment to writing about my father is that I hated him so much. Yeah. And, you know, the writing was just angry and bitter and resentful. And so not very good. You know, and it wasn't until he got dementia that he first said that he loved me. And that's how I knew he had dementia, because I knew something must be wrong if he had said he loved me, you know. But when my dad softened, I saw this kind of childlike, innocent part of him emerge. And I was able to fall somewhat in love with that part of him. And so when I thought about writing this book, which my editor at Avid Reader Press, Jovi Ferrari Adler, had suggested that I do, I kept trying to write it in a more literary, formal voice, and it just wasn't working. And then when I just started writing directly to my father and started to write this letter to him of all the things that I never was able to say to him, and I never was going to get the chance to say to him, it just started pouring out of me. So I wouldn't say it was a conscious choice. I feel like it was the only way that I could write this book. The format kind of chose itself.
Well, it is painful in parts to read, especially about your childhood as you were really living under the thumb of your father. Are you afraid we're going to judge him? I mean, you love him now. He says he loves you, or he has said he loved you. But early on, he was a difficult man to be with. Were you afraid of our judgments of him?
I was, primarily because I judged him so harshly myself. You know, the funny thing is that, you know, I was terrified of writing this book, and I was really worried that it was a betrayal of my blood, my family. But I knew that I had to tell this story because my father very privately told me, particularly after he got dementia, the story of his father. And he was so upset that he had never confronted his father. He had never talked about these things. And he had a chance at the end of my grandfather's life, and he didn't take it.
Yeah.
And so I knew that I needed to talk about these things. And as the book has gone out, what's really been surprising is how many, particularly men, but even women too, have reached out to me and said, this is exactly what happened to me when I was a kid too. And so I look at it more, less that I'm judging my father, I'm inviting people to judge him, but just kind of bringing this out into the sunlight, you know, to disinfect it, you know, to let it heal, and to give other people the opportunity to start talking about these things as well. Because I suffered for so long in silence, which created so much shame. So I was worried about people judging my dad, but I also knew that I needed to tell this story and I needed to talk about these things.
Well, you are a writer, and writers write, but was it easier, do you think, then to write it than it would have been to say any of this to him?
I would have loved to have been able to say this to my father. And I tried many, many times. My father is somebody who is not capable of having conversations the way that I would like to have conversations. My analyst has many times wondered if my dad might be on the spectrum.
Oh, interesting.
He's not very good at understanding other people's emotions. When he gets overwhelmed or he feels self-conscious, he resorts to yelling and rage very quickly. I was always a very sensitive, emotional kid, so I tried a billion different ways to talk to my father. And I think that his inability to talk to me is what probably made me a good teacher when I was working with high school kids, because I knew exactly what they needed, because it was just the thing that I didn't get. And then later, I think it also made me a good writer because I spent the entirety of my childhood psychoanalyzing and trying to figure out my father and figure out what's going on in his head. It gave me this amazing ability to empathize with him. It also created an incredible amount of anxiety as well. So I wouldn't recommend doing this to children, but it did give me these insights that my father just didn't have.
In fact, you write that you watched him. I mean, you studied your father, and I would assume when you live in an abusive household or even a household that feels terrorized by a parent, you want to know how you're going to feel safe, how you're going to protect yourself, what's going to happen next. That you get to be a very good detective of the abusive parent.
Yeah, I think very early on, one of the defenses that kids develop is this kind of sixth sense to try to figure out what the triggers are. So you live, you know, when you're a kid, you're supposed to be trying to figure out who you are. But for me, it was always, what do I have to do to make sure my father doesn't go off or upset him? And so I became, in some ways, the adult of the household, because I was trying to contain him. I was trying to soothe him, and it was a perversion. It was an inverted power structure that was really, I had no idea how damaging that was to me as a kid. I do now after, you know, 6 years of therapy, and a lot of reading. But, you know, it's just something that happens intuitively, and the psyche is just this wonderful thing that will find ways to protect us. And so I think my psyche was doing the best it could to keep me alive throughout my childhood. But then once I left that house, you know, my psyche started reacting that way in an airport. You know, it's like everyone could be my father. I've got to monitor, you know, 1,000 people in the room. I've got to be hyper vigilant about things. And that's really where anxiety kicked in, you know, particularly in my early teens. I mean, I always had anxiety even as a kid. I was a very anxious kid, and it became overwhelming when I got into college, and that's what led to the drinking. You know, as soon as I started drinking, it was just this magical cure for anxiety that came with other pitfalls.
Indeed, which I do want to get to. I would love to have you read just a paragraph from your book. And this is about your father coming home from work. The family is together. He comes in the door, and you describe what happens, how it feels.
Just before dinner on weeknights, the sound of you opening our front door was like hearing the hammer of an old single-action revolver being cocked. Only you weren't playing John Wayne. You hadn't come to save us from bad guys. It often felt more like you were taxi drivers, Travis Bickle, in a suit and tie. Once you were home, the pistol was always cocked. I never knew when the gun was going to go off, but I was always certain it would be fired at me. And whatever levity or play your children and wife might have been enjoying, all of that ended the second your shadow darkened our home.
One of the things that you do in this book, and you did with therapy, which was to help understand yourself, obviously, but also your father and where he came from, where that rage came from. And in some part, it comes from his own father, Pop-Pop, who was your Pop-Pop, who loved you and was very affectionate with you, but so different with your father. How did he treat him?
Yeah, you know, my grandfather grew up in Philadelphia, on the streets. His dad was didn't do well in life, didn't give him a lot of instructions. They were poor. You know, they had to skip rent all the time. His family broke up when he was a teenager. His sisters had to quit high school to go to work. And so my grandfather had a lot of shame around poverty. And then he was, of course, sent to fight in World War II. And, you know, it was a great war where we were fighting the Nazis, but he had to do horrific things over there. My uncle was a Vietnam vet, and he talked to me a lot about his experience in Vietnam. And he told me that my grandfather had to do horrific things in World War II. Except when they came home, they never talked about it.
Right.
So, you know, my grandfather came home and he already had a child waiting for him. And, you know, I think there's a line in the book where I say, you know, just crossing the Atlantic after you've been killing people for a year doesn't make you father of the year. And I think my grandfather had horrific PTSD. I think he had horrible shame about his childhood. I think he had no role model for what a father was supposed to be. The only thing he knew was war and the army. And so he raised his boys like he was still in the army and he was still in a war. And I think that profoundly affected my father. And I, you know, if my father was on the spectrum or is on the spectrum, again, that's something that people didn't understand back then. So my grandfather used to call my dad Michelle. His name's Michael, but he would call him Michelle because he wasn't living up to his standards of manhood. My grandmother always wanted a girl, so he said Michael could be Michelle. And I know my grandfather hit my father, beat him, you know. It was just kind of the way, you know, back then. And this strange twist of fate is my grandfather, when I came along, you know, in his late life, he had mellowed out, and I was firstborn grandson, and that meant something in my family. And my grandfather adored me, and it saved me because I wasn't getting that love at home. But it created this cycle that my father would abuse me. I'd go to see my grandfather would love me, and then my father would hate the fact that I was getting from his father what he never got. So it created this vicious cycle of jealousy and envy that he would punish me for. And then I would go to my grandfather, recover, and I would come home and be punished again. So I didn't really understand that when I was a kid, but I was caught in this eddy that was just spinning and spinning generationally.
Well, let me pick up on that after this very short break. Matthew Quick is our guest today on The Connection. He's got a memoir, a brand new book called Dad, Love Me. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with writer Matthew Quick about his troubled relationship with his abusive father. And again, he's got a new book, a memoir, a letter to his father, who now has dementia, and it's titled Dad, Love Me. You begin in this book with a story of you know, one of your troubled contacts with your father turning to your mother saying, "Why, you know, why doesn't Dad love me?" And she says, "Oh, he does. He does love you." Did you believe her?
I wanted to believe her when I was a child. You know, I think my mom was kind of my rock. And my analysts, we've talked about this a lot. You know, he, in Jungian analysis, you talk about story is medicine. And he said, my analyst told me that my mother gave me the story I needed to keep me alive. You know, and I think that that was very true. I think my father... And you know, I worked on this analysis too. He showed his love in the ways that he knew. You know, he went out and worked every day. He put food on the table. He bought clothes. He was faithful to my mother. You know, I think in modern times we might say that's a very low bar. But in order for me to go back and try to find some positive in my father. I had to really go back and emphasize those things. He didn't love me in the way that I wanted him to love me. He didn't love me in the way that I needed him to love me growing up. But I think in some ways my father did do the best that he could, given his circumstances, his upbringing, his capacities. And I think my mother was trying to emphasize that at the time. She also was a product of religious upbringing. She wasn't going to divorce him. So, this was, we were making the best we could.
I mean, obviously, very complicated things that are happening at home. And you describe several scenes, including one where your dad really does beat you up, and no one is there to defend you or to protect you. I mean, in a sense, you're on your own. You're by yourself. It must have been a lonely place to be.
Yeah, there's a scene in the book where I get in trouble. I think it was in sixth grade for stealing liquor. My friend and I stole liquor from his dad's cabinet. And, one of the things that his dad said to me was that I can't even tell your father what happened because he would overdo it. Like he would go psycho on you. So I have to really impress upon you that you can't do this. And I remember at the time realizing the gift of that, because it was the first time I realized that anyone else could tell that maybe there's something off about my dad. And it was such a relief because I thought, can no one else see this? And apparently everyone did see it. It's just that everyone didn't really know what to do about it in the 80s. That was frustrating. It was sad. And looking back, there's a lot of pain that, these types of experiences were tolerated. I had somebody write me just this weekend the beautiful handwritten letter in response to the book, a man in New York, and he said, I read this book and these exact things happened to me.
Wow.
And he said it was just, I didn't think anyone knew outside of my sister, about this experience. And he said he read the first three lines and he just started crying when he got to that part when my mother says to me, of course, your father loves you, because he said that's exactly what his mother said to him when his father had abused him. And so I think that this is, particularly as somebody who grew up in the 70s and 80s, there's this culture of silence, this culture of shame, there's this culture of tough it out. And I didn't realize how damaging that was because it was just kind of the water we were all swimming in. And I try to look back and I try to look at it with grace because I think the other people in my neighborhood, my family, even my mom, there just wasn't a lot of education about these things.
Well, I appreciate your honesty in talking about this because I think it's such an important thing to talk about, and I want to just dig a little bit deeper,
Sure.
because on the one hand, there was the cruelty, frankly, that your father visited on you, but also the coldness, and also you say, when you would walk into a room, he didn't light up, he didn't even hardly acknowledge your presence. And I wonder, sort of, those two poles of being the focus of his rage and then being invisible to him.
Yeah, I would say the invisibility was worse.
Really?
I think it was worse, because the rage or even, being pushed against a wall or thrown down or whatever, that hurt, but it was something that you can kind of understand, conceptualize. I grew up in a rough neighborhood. Kids fought,
Right.
but I didn't understand being ignored. Because no one else did that. I went into the houses of my friends, and again, it was kind of a blue collar neighborhood. They weren't touchy feely men, but they lit up around their sons. They would light up when I walked into the room. And so it was very strange for me to realize, I never really thought, what's wrong with my dad when I was a kid? I would always think, what's wrong with me? I would internalize it. And I've done a lot of reading on this, and it's a defense mechanism because when you're a child, you can't fix your dad. It's devastating if your parent is not able to perform the way that they need to. So you say, I must be able to fix myself. And so that's what I tried to do. And that was so painful because you just internalize this idea that there's something broken or something wrong with you at the core. And even with my writing career, I just kept bringing bigger and bigger prizes to my father. Famously, when I told him I wanted to be a writer, he called me an idiot, told me I was stupid. And then, I come and I say, Dad, I have a book contract, and a movie deal. Like, this is real. And he said to me two things. He goes, you have to pay taxes on that money, was the first thing he
Jeez.
said. And then the second thing he said is, I'm going to write a book someday. And that was
Wow.
it. Like, there was no congratulations. There was no, you proved me wrong. And so, we did our Charlie Brown and Lucy routine. He's just always pulling the football away every time, no matter how hard I tried.
You talk about your own anger, your own rage, your tornado-like fury, and one can understand a child having to deal with this onslaught of either abuse or complete ignoring of your existence.
Yeah, and I think the hardest thing too was, as hard as it was to deal with my father's rage and his inability to regulate his emotions and his coldness, that was also being constantly mobbed for me. That was kind of at the pinnacle of our household. Like, he was the king, and this is how you maintain power. This was the worldview that which I knew was wrong, even as a 5-year-old or 6-year-old. I knew this is not right. But it was the only model that I had, and my grandfather and my uncle were my other kind of men in my life. They were very damaged war veterans, and they had this also very aggressive us versus them, don't trust anybody worldview. And so that's all I had growing up, and so it was tough, going to college and meeting other people in the world. It was so shocking because all of a sudden I'm amongst people who had radically different ideas about the world, which is exciting, but also so alienating. And so I never felt like I fit in at home or anywhere else either.
Did you
And
turn
that was
that,
a struggle.
yeah, did you turn that rage in on yourself?
I think I mostly turned it in on myself. I
Really?
think that's I think my father raged outward, and I'm not going to say that I've never raged outward, but I think my primary, target is always inward. I always go inward, and that's a problem too. I think it's probably better than raging outward unless you're raging at an appropriate topic. But it's taken me a lot of work to start being kinder to myself, and I'm still working on that.
It's a good thing to be working on. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that is Matthew Quick, our guest today on The Connection. He's written a number of books, many of them for young adults or for children. I guess it's like teenage children largely. And his very first book, The Silver Linings Playbook, was made into an Oscar-winning film. And he's got a new book, a memoir called Dad, Love Me. You started drinking. What did alcohol give you that you didn't have?
Relief. I
Relief
think
from
that's
what?
really
From what?
from anxiety. It was the only time I remember the first time I got drunk, like really properly drunk in college. It was the first time I felt the lack of, it's the first time I really knew what anxiety was, because it was the first time I didn't feel it.
Wow.
And I thought to myself instantly, oh, wait, this is everyone else's baseline. This is how everyone wakes up in the morning. And it became almost irresistible to me. And I was talking to somebody who had a family member that was going through alcohol recovery, and they're saying, well, why can't they just drink one drink? Why can't they just drink one drink? And I said, imagine if someone held your head underwater for 20 years, and then your head finally, you let the head come up and they get a breath, and then they put it right back underwater. And you said, why can't you just have one breath of air? That's how it felt to me when I had my first experience with drunkenness. It felt like I could breathe after 20 some years of not breathing.
You also write that it quenched a kind of insatiable need to disappear. Maybe that's what you mean, which you weren't feeling anxious because you could disappear yourself.
Yeah, you know, drinking is a regressive thing, you know, and I talked a lot about my analyst with my analysts about what it means symbolically, and one of the things that drinking does is it returns you to this kind of childlike state. It almost puts you back into the womb. Like you get this feeling of being warm, of being taken care of not having any worries, and it really is this regression. And so I think that that was a good trade for a long time, and it worked for me for many years because I had to go through a lot of anxiety to write and to battle in the arenas of publishing in Hollywood. But there was always that relief at the end of the night, you know. And I think that was the thing, you know. I could get through anything if I knew there was an off switch at 7 o'clock.
You did get sober, and this doesn't feel fair at all. And then you got writer's block. I mean,
I
again,
know, right?
that seems like the wrong kind of punishment for getting sober. But you did.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's a unique problem. You know, I think alcohol and drugs have been forever linked to the creative process. You know, I do think that it awakens things in you, but I also think that there was this relationship that I had that I could go to these scary places, that I could take these scary risks, as again, as long as there was something that could shut it off at the end of the day. And then to do all of those scary things, to put yourself out there, to emote on the page, to mine your deepest, darkest secrets, and then there was no relief at the end of the day. You know, it wasn't a conscious thing, but I was shocked by it. You know, and I think I was just terrified to write because I didn't have that safety valve anymore. So it took a while for me to work through that.
You write, "My desperate need to fill the dad-shaped hole in me. That's the power source that's fueled every line of writing I have ever produced."
Yeah, and I think that the pain of trying and trying to get my father to love me, and no matter what it was, like if I went to the Oscars, if I'm hanging out with celebrities, if I make money, if I buy a nice house, or if I marry the right person, it just there's nothing that would ever work. But it was that carrot that I was chasing for so long, and I think that. You know, I always joke that, you know, if you want your kid to be a writer and you're good to him, you know, that kid's doomed.
It's
They're
never
not
going to
gonna be a
happen.
good writer. It's never gonna
Dear.
happen. You know, like the recipe for, you know, getting someone to spend their life in a room alone, you know, creating fictional characters, trying to please this audience, you know, it really was fuel. I didn't know it at the time. You know, I didn't know what I was trying to do. But I was trying to fill this hole inside of me, this need for love. I would have never framed it that way when I was drinking, but now looking back, it just seems so obvious to me.
You went into Jungian analysis, and your therapist said to you, "You need the right life-saving narrative." Now he's talking to a fiction writer who creates these stories, but he was saying that the story, it sounded like he was saying the story that you are telling yourself isn't working for you. Is that in the ballpark?
Yeah, I think he was saying the story I was telling myself worked for me for 40 years, and then it stopped working, you know. And I think that one of the things we talked a lot about in my analysis was that the psyche does the best it can given the circumstances, you know, that you're given in life, and it could very well be that alcohol kept me alive for 20 years because
Wow.
I wasn't ready to deal with all of the problems with my that you know. When I first went into analysis, you know, one of the things my analyst said was that one of the difference between perhaps some other therapies and Jungian analysis is that the goal is not to make it hurt less right away. The goal is to go deeper into the pain. So my analyst said, this is going to hurt way worse. It's going to hurt worse than anything you've ever done. Ever because, but if you can go through that crucifixion, you're going to get to the other side and you will rise again, you know. And so, my analyst isn't a Christian, but he knew that I was raised in a Christian home, so he started using those myths and that language so that I could kind of grasp onto those stories to get me through the early stages of that.
I mean, it sounds like, and I think this is probably true with a lot of therapy, is that the patient will fight the therapist, and you come into therapy, and then you fight the therapist along the way, and you have a lot of conversation between you and your therapist, who you call Zeus, and it sounds like you were pushing back with him.
Yeah, you know, I'll try not to get too jargony, but you know, you have these psychological defenses. We all do, and we have them, and they work. That's why we use them. And so one of the things you do in analysis is to illuminate these defenses and then try to figure out better ways to get through life without the defenses. So I had a lot of stories. I had a lot of mechanisms that I did not want to give up initially. You know, and one of the stories that I had was that my father owes me. You know, he wronged me. And he owes me, and I'm going to hold him to account. I'm going to be my father's loan shark. He's going to pay me at some time. And Zeus said, that's a terrible story for you, you know, because it makes you resentful. It makes you angry. It makes you bitter. It makes you just constantly judging everything your father does. You need a better story. And so the story we came up with was that I need to save my father. I need to redeem him. And that became the story. And that's really the journey of the memoir, you know, trying to redeem the not only my father, but the archetype of the father, you know, the good king, you know, this idea that there is something within the masculinity of my father and myself that is good and noble. And we have to find that and write that and get back on the right course.
We're almost up on a break here, but I think what we learn in therapy too is that there are bits and pieces of our parents that live inside us. You see your father in you?
Yes,
about 30 seconds, Matthew, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Zeus will talk all the time about how half of your father's DNA is your DNA, you know, like, and you were raised by him. So, you know, everything you knew about the world came from him for the first 20 years of your life. So, of course, like, I wanted to divorce myself from my father, say, I am not my father. And one of the stories I had to say is that I am my father and I have to redeem both of us. Because if I hate my father, I'm going to hate at least 50% of myself for the rest of my life. And I don't want to do that.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Matthew Quick, our guest today on The Connection. He's written a number of books and he's got a brand new one. It's a memoir titled Dad, Love Me. And we've been talking about his relationship with his father, also what he learned from his therapist. He was in Jungian therapy for a number of years, much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about what it takes to forgive an abusive parent, especially when things like old age and dementia rob them of the ability to say they're sorry. And that's what Matthew Quick writes about in his new book, a memoir titled Dad, Love Me. We were talking about your therapist, again, who you call Zeus, which I guess tells us how you think about him. But one of the things that he says to you is that your novels are about that all your novels are about wanting to be loved. Was he right?
I think so. You know, I think in some ways, all writing is about wanting to please an audience. It's about wanting to connect with an audience. It's about wanting approval. It's about wanting someone to spend hours with your words, your thoughts. And I do think that for me, because I just didn't get that from my father, that was, again, this driving force. It was not conscious at all. But I think I set out as a young man to fill, again, this hole that was inside of me. And somehow I just settled on fiction writing, and that's what it became.
You're right, Dad. I'm sorry for wanting you to be something you weren't. I'm sorry for judging you so harshly back when I was a younger man. I mean, you're obviously writing this having gone through this, you know, this very difficult time in your life and also this therapy to help put all those pieces together. But being able to say you weren't the right dad for me, but maybe he was the right dad for you at the same time. He was the only dad you got, so.
Yeah, my mother would say to me all the time, I can't give you another father. This is what you've got. And I think I had two choices in life. I could spend my entire life being resentful about, getting the dad that I didn't want. Or I could look and say, having this father produce this person of me in the world, and that gave me the life that I have. It made me the person that my wife fell in love with. It made me the teacher that I was. And, I was on book tour, and some of my former students showed up from,
Oh,
20 years
wow.
ago. It was amazing, I think it has made me the writer that I am. So I think the better choice for me was to be grateful for the life. It's not that I would ever say again, I don't think we should reverse engineer fiction writers by, torturing children. Like I'm not for that. I want to be clear. But I do think once the damage is done, you need a way to frame it. For me anyway, healing, it became about framing this. The first half of my life was about being angry and resentful, and I needed a lot of alcohol to live that life. The second half of my life, I want to be about acceptance and forgiveness and transcendence. A lot of people have Forgiveness has been this touchy word that I've been talking to people about, and I don't condone what my father did. I'm not giving him a pass. I'm saying this happened, and I need to transcend it. And by transcending it, I can choose to love my father as he is, not as I wish he would be.
You didn't give up on him. I mean, I know some people, and I've interviewed some people that had, terrible relationships with abusive parents, and they said, "I'm done with you. We're done. We're over. This relationship is done." You did not do that. What kept you going? And maybe it was therapy, but what kept you going? What kept you connected, if I can use that word?
There's a brief time when I did go briefly no contact with my father. It didn't last long. And it coincided right around the time that I got sober. And, my father's dementia really was this kind of window to get back in. But I think also I used to say things to my mother, like the thing I want most in the world is just my father's approval. I just want him to look at me in a loving way. I want to have some relationship with my father. I don't know why that was so essential for me or essential for humans. I think this is kind of a universal thing, but particularly amongst men, we look to our fathers and we want to have that approval. We're so maybe hardwired to get that. And so there was this itch that I could never scratch. And I wouldn't even say that I've scratched it fully now. My dad is the memory care unit, and he never became all-star dad. He never became the dad that did all of the right things. But through watching him fail with dementia and how childlike he came, it gave me an opportunity to be a father to him. And so I go to memory care now and I bathe him.
Wow.
I literally wash him. I shave him. I need to give him instructions to get into a car. Like I need to tell him, okay, dad, pick your foot up and step into the car. Now we're going to sit down. So I very much have become this kind of father figure to my dad. If we're out in public, he's always looking to me as to what to do. And in that way, I feel like I've been able to redeem both of us because I've been able to transcend how my father was. It would be very easy for me to justify being as mean to him as he was to me, but it seems absurd for me to do those things, now that he has dementia. So it's been this great gift for me to really step into the role of the good father and to give my father the good father that he never had, to love him in the way that he was never loved as a child. That's been deeply healing for him, I think, and it's been profoundly healing for me.
And seeing him as a vulnerable person, a vulnerable man, and as you say, seeing the child, I guess, in him. You describe being with him, and he's looking at the clouds and describing them like animals. I mean, the way children will often do when they see clouds that look like animals.
Yeah, he became very obsessed with flowers. And my father never saw the beauty in anything. Like he never took joy in anything. And now, if he sees an azalea bush in bloom, he'll point at it and he'll say, "Look how beautiful that is!" And it's like a 5-year-old boy delighting in. Or he'll see a turtle and he'll just be, "It's a turtle! It's wonderful! Look at that! Do you see that?" And you really just see him as this, you can't not see him as this grown child. And there's something just so tragic and sweet and beautiful about it. There's a scene in my book when we're looking at clouds, and my father makes this comment about what song is about clouds. And if you spend enough time around people who have dementia, you start to become their memory bank. And it's very strange. Like, I instantly know what my dad means. And I said, "Oh, you mean, Both Sides Now by Joni Mitchell. Do you want to
Of
listen to
course.
that?" And so I put it on, and he starts whispering it almost like a prayer as he's looking at the clouds. And it was this almost transcendent, holy moment for me. I've never seen my dad acting in this way that was more pure, honest, transparent. He was looking at the wonder of the cloud. He was singing the song he remembered from his youth. He was so in touch with it. It brought tears to my eyes. It was such a healing moment for me, because this person that I thought didn't have any humanity, his humanity was just so vividly on display for me.
I'm sure as a younger person, a younger man, you wanted your dad to say, "I'm sorry." I mean, is he even capable of that now? Does he even know what he would have been sorry for?
I think now that's definitely slipping away from him now.
Yeah.
And there are moments where he slips in. He often thinks I'm his older brother, Peter. So that's the window for that is closing. The closest my dad ever got to saying he was sorry was to often say, "I know I'm the dad in the Silver Linings Playbook, the book, not the movie." Because in the book, the dad is much worse than the Hollywood Robert De Niro quirky, charming character that we get on screen. And so my father saw himself in that character. And I think he was never angry with me for the depiction. I think he was sad about it. He never said, "I'm sorry that I did these things to you," but that was the closest that he got. And I think that might be the best I'm going to get.
So how would you describe then? I mean, it sounds like a parent-child relationship now, although you're the parent and he's the child. I mean, do you feel like you still want something from him that he might not be able to give you? Or are you more at peace?
I think I'm more at peace than I used to be. There's a part of me that will always want that, and I've gone looking for that with multiple older men. I've practically begged older men in my life to be father figures. I think the transition that's happening now is that I realize that I need to be the father figure. And I mentor some younger men. One of my former students, I've been able to help her get an agent and a book contract. I don't think that they would think of me as a father, but I think of it as father energy. I try to show up for these people, and I try to contain my own messiness, and I try to show up in a way for them that makes their lives better. And that's what I do for my dad. At the point now, I realize that he was never able to help me with my problems or to empathize with me or to listen. And now he can't do those things. So that's off the table. But I realize how much I needed them, and I realize that other people need those too. So the way that I deal with that now is I say, "Well, maybe I can be the good father to other people in some small way. Like, maybe I can show up, and when I can and I'm rested and my mental health is good, I try to do that for other people."
Do you feel like you're a father to yourself? Are
I'm
you
trying to
raising
be.
yourself? Raising yourself?
Yeah, that's it. That's harder than other people, isn't it?
Yes, it
It's funny
is.
how that is, but yeah, I do think that is the next step, going forth, in midlife into the end, is really learning how to be kinder to myself, to turn off the inner bad dad inside of me that's just, constantly criticizing. My wife is on me all the time. No matter how much success I have, it's never enough. It's never, I've never done a good enough job. I always could have done something better. I'll go and probably listen to this interview afterwards and think of all the many things that I should have said, or I could have done better for
Ouch.
Marty,
Right, right, right.
But that's just, I think, turning that volume down and, really taking the time to say, you have accomplished some things. You are human, and you've done pretty well with what you've done. I think that's the final frontier, and I'm getting there.
You mentioned both your dad and your granddad and uncle, some of whom had fought in wars. And there's, so much discussion now about masculinity and what that is supposed to be, and whether you suck it up and be tough and don't show that you're weak. And it seems that is an absolute recipe for suffering. And I just, I think your story helps us deal and push back against that kind of narrative about what it is to be a man.
Yeah, in some ways, I feel as though the memoir is so radically in the opposite direction that we come full circle a little bit, because I do think that, the great writer Nathan Hill blurbed my book, and he said to me, "I just can't believe how brave it is that you did this. So, it
Wow.
took a lot of bravery to do this." So, I was really touched by that comment. I'm such a fan of his work, but it was one of those moments when I realized that, oh yeah, this is brave. This is something my grandfather, who fought the Nazis, and my uncle, who spent a year in Vietnam, like, they couldn't do this. Like, they weren't, tough enough, if we want to use that language, to be this vulnerable. So I think reframing masculinity, because I do think men are hardwired to do hard things, to do brave things, to want to be useful to their community, to put po something positive in there. So I think reframing masculinity to in service of things that are going to help us a little bit more, I think that's the upgrade. I think that's the rebrand, if you will, that could be useful for all of us.
As you write this book, you're writing about writing the book, and asking people's permission, including your mother and your father. Your mother has a great response, which was, "Who will play me in the movie?" which was a great response. Your dad, you don't really tell us what he says to you about writing this book. It's a mystery.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the reasons for that is, and I struggle with this, is that my dad really couldn't give consent.
Right, right.
He knew I was writing the book, and I talked to him about it ad nauseum. I interviewed him. He's very aware. But there are many times when, we would pass my house on a walk, which was only 2 blocks from his house, and he'd say, "Oh, that's my brother Peter's house, and he's writing a book about us."
Oh,
So
wow.
I would realize that, like, he can't give consent. Like, he doesn't understand fully what's happening, and that was a tough thing, because I really wanted to talk to my father about it, and I would, and I would, but cognitively he just was unable to really go there, and so it was difficult. And I tried to be really respectful about this, that I didn't want to imply things that weren't there. My mother, of course, did give her consent, and was very supportive. It was a struggle for her,
I
because
bet.
you know I'm talking about things that we haven't talked about for 50 years that we've kept secret. But I think it's been healing for her too, as her friends have read it. I think she's been surprised by how much support she's gotten. There's not been this rush of people to judge or condemn. It's more just people that I think were sad that these things happened, and want to be supportive, and want to talk about these things. And I think there's also a lot of other people that have been, me too. These things have happened in my life, and we haven't talked about them either. And I think that's always fertile ground for healing.
Is that why you write? To
I
talk
think
about
so.
things?
I think I write because I started writing at a very young age, because nobody would talk to me about my emotions and my feelings. And I just needed to. And I think I'm still doing that. And, it's always lovely when people say, "I'm a fan of your work," or, "I love the movie," or, "I've read all your books." But when people say to me, and this happens quite often, "Like, your book made me feel less alone," that's when I really feel like I've done my job. Because that's why I went to books as a kid, because I felt so terribly alone. And even now, as an adult with a healthy life and friends, I still go to books to feel less alone, because I think something happens on the page that too often really doesn't happen in real life, where we can't quite get there somehow, but we can get there through art.
Matthew Quick, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for writing the book and for joining us today on The Connection.
Thanks so much, Marty. It was lovely speaking with you.
And again, Matthew Quick's new book, a memoir, is titled Dad, Love Me. His very first book, The Silver Linings Playbook, was a bestseller, and it was also made into an Oscar-winning movie. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. The Connection is produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.